Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. My guest today is Elizabeth Ando, who already joined us 13 times and shared her truly deep insight into traditional Japanese food culture. Elizabeth is a food writer and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan for over 50 years. And she runs a culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Kitchen, and the Kansha, celebrating Japan's vegan and vegetarian traditions. And today's topic is Japanese curry. Curry is a universally popular dish, but like many other things, Japanese people remodeled original and created a unique style of their own. Now, Japanese people eat Japanese-style curry as often as every 5 days, and the sales of the curry products totals 100 billion Japanese yen, or $660 million annually. So today we'll discuss when and how curry arrived in Japan, how it transformed into a unique style, the difference between Japanese and other styles of curry, delicious variations of curry flavored products, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on the iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Elizabeth Ando. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome back to the Japan Eats.
Thank you. Delighted to be back again.
Yeah, so you are the most frequent guest, and we should give you some medals or something at some point.
No, it's my pleasure to be able to talk about so many different things and to have such an audience that's eager to learn.
Right. Well, you're a live encyclopedia of actual modern than the traditional Japanese cuisine. So listeners who wants to know Elizabeth's fascinating life story about moving to Japan, how she met her lovely Japanese husband, how she started her culinary career, and many other unique experiences, please go to episode 18. And also her previous 13 episodes on Japan Eats are truly fun and informative. So if you're interested in learning from her tremendously valuable and practical knowledge of Japanese food, please go to heritageradionetwork.org and search Elizabeth Ando. That's A-N-D-O-H. So, but for listeners who have not listened to the previous episodes, what do you like to eat in your life in Japan?
Well, it has evolved. Usually bread for breakfast, it's easiest. Noodles for lunch. My early life in Japan was spent on the island of Shikoku in Kagawa Prefecture, which is known for its udon culture, and it left a lasting impression. And then rice for dinner. Washoku, definitely. Mostly vegetables, some fish and some meat, lots of tofu. I came to Japanese food rather late. I mean, I first ate it when I came to Japan, and I was already in my 20s by then. So it just, I'm making up for lost time. I don't really eat much but washoku.
Right. Well, that's why you stay healthy. And it's amazing, right, that what you eat mainly is all carbs, and which is very unusual. But Japanese people love carbs, really. So, and stay healthy.
It's true. I definitely am a carboholic. I could not live without carbs.
Right. Definitely. So it's kind of counterintuitive, but you stay slim and healthy and pretty, and that's thanks to Japanese food, I can say. All right. So let's talk about Japanese curry. So first of all, how popular is Japanese curry in Japan? I mentioned earlier, but maybe you can tell more.
Really, really popular. I mean, I had always assumed it was, and then you asked me to take a look and to think about it. And I went online, and there were a number of research companies that had lots of data, but all of them were pretty much the same numbers. And more than once a week was at least 1 in 10. People who ate curry more than once a month was 80%. And it was across all age groups. I mean, everything from young kids, teenagers, all the way through to people in their 70s and 80s. And the numbers were very much the same, no matter who you looked at. So the answer is people eat a lot of curry. They like curry.
Yeah, there's so many. We won't talk about it, but we have a lot of products, curry-based products. And also even the curry, we look at very cubed roots, but they have a different range of spiciness, the sweetness, to the whole variation of it. So
huge range of products, and also opportunities to eat curry, and everything from very sort of casual to pretty upscale. Although in general, curry is thought of as a comfort food. It's nothing elegant, but it's something dependable. And everybody seems to like it. Interestingly, I had never eaten curry before I came to Japan. So for me, it didn't seem foreign in the sense that it seemed very Japanese from the very start. I must say my very earliest encounter, it was not particularly delicious. I would not have listed it among my favorite foods. It was at the ICU Shokudo, International Christian University, which is, I was enrolled in their program to learn Japanese. And they had their own cafeteria. And certainly it was the fastest and cheapest option. And I had it often. I was pleased when I finally got a chance to eat it someplace else, and it really tasted good. But that was my very first encounter.
Mm. And you have more memories about curry, right?
Yes. Well, so just another word about the ICU. I forget the exact price. The yen was 360 to the dollar when I first went to Japan. But it was cheap. And for very few yen, maybe 10 yen more, you could get an extra helping of rice. And as mentioned, I'm a carboholic, so that interested me. And it was also easier. The curry in the cafeteria was pretty intense. And so I would get a single portion of curry and a double portion of rice. And that's how I sort of made it through. But I'll fast forward many, many years later. My daughter was still young, and we as a family moved to New York for several years. And at the time, one of my husband's sisters was living in New Jersey, and with her Japanese husband and her children. They would invite us for Thanksgiving. She would make a formal American Thanksgiving and for her American friends. And then we would come the next day and she would make curry out of the leftovers and out of the turkey carcass. And her turkey curry was really delicious. And as my daughter was growing up, that was her impression of what curry was too. And it's interesting, fast forward, my daughter is very grown up and has her own daughter, and she always makes turkey curry. And she has a crowd over for late Thanksgiving. Everybody else does ordinary Thanksgiving elsewhere. And then they all come to her house to eat turkey curry. And it's the best part. She puts a lot in the freezer and saves it for me when I come visit too.
Right. So yeah, 2024, Thanksgiving leftover turkey turned to curry. You're creating a new trend.
it's terrific. It really is. Lots of wonderful stock comes out of the turkey carcass, and it's all the bits and pieces that people did not originally decide they wanted to eat, but they're repurposed.
And completely different flavor profile and texture. So, okay. All right. So, but curry didn't exist in Japan until fairly recently. So when did curry come to Japan, and who brought curry to Japan?
Well, there were several different stories. They all, again, sort of centered around the same time frame, which was the very end of Bakumatsu, is the very end of the Tokugawa, the shogunate period. And just as Meiji was getting established, the emperor was back on the throne, and the Meiji era was known in Japan, this 1860s, 1870s, was known for its innovation, its innovative ways. Japan had really been closed off from the rest of the world, not a great deal of interaction on any level, culinary included, for hundreds of years. And with the Meiji Restoration, a lot of influences came in, primarily from Europe, although there were also Asian influences as well. The date that of curry rice being on a menu, and it was the menu of a military preparatory school, was 1873. But there were certain names that were associated with it as well, and one is Dr. William Clark. Most Americans probably do not find that name familiar. And he was the founder of an agricultural college, the first institute in Japan to actually issue a formal degree in education. He's also known in Japan for being an educator. But he was responsible, it seems, for putting curry rice on the college menu every other day. The college itself was founded in 1876. And so the history of the verified history of curry in Japan, I guess, comes from it being on menus and there being written record that it was left behind. It's possible there were some adventurous people who were eating it, but it wasn't listed on a menu before then.
Right. And also heard that the British curry powder was imported to Japan, and the people realized that, well, it's easy to make curry.
So, absolutely.
Right. That was a powder from back then. And yes, and also, like, you know, after closing the country for, you know, to block Christianity and other negative influence for Shogun's governance, Japan closed the country for about 200 years. But right after they opened the country, they have to keep up with the Western influence.
Right.
And they have to start eating meat, which is banned by Japanese emperor, like in the 7th century. So curry is also kind of a very Western food that converted Japanese diet dramatically. And maybe that's another reason curry is kind of like a very symbolic term of Western food.
It's interesting. I think so, because it combines rice eating, which was, you know, very much compatible with the Japanese notion of what made a meal. I mean, you know, you don't really eat until you've had your rice. And I think the flavor profile was more, was not challenging to the Japanese. So the combination of it being a style of eating that was not new in the sense that it felt comfortable for them. But the whole notion of pouring something or eating something on top of the rice was probably more avant-garde, more a newer kind of trend. Usually rice was served as a separate food, but curry rice was putting the curry on top of the rice.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, because Japanese traditional style of eating was ichiju sansai, one soup, one rice, and three other separate dishes. So, yeah, that's interesting that rice covered with something really satisfying and rich. No wonder everybody starts loving it. But do you know why curry became so popular so quickly?
I think the one point that you made is that there were convenient forms for making it. And so there were places where you could go eat it. In other words, restaurants as well. And the most elegant, I guess, was a place in Ginza in the 1870s. And it was a high-priced menu on the cafeteria, Fugetsudo, which originated in Kobe. And Kobe was also a port city that had a lot of influences coming into Japan. Yokohama, further up north, near what is current-day Tokyo, and further down was Kobe. And Kobe was also always a center for things coming from India and from other parts of Asia. So there might have been some connection there with it as well. But I think one of the reasons why it became so popular so quickly was because it could be made simply. It didn't require any special skill. And there were products that were being produced, at first the powders and then these kinds of pastes, roux, that would make it very easy for people to make it at home.
Right. Yeah, so there are varieties of, you know, restaurant, like dining out right. format. The first restaurant you mentioned, that's kind of a yoshoku right. style, like Western right. food. Now it's almost like its own uniquely own category, originally right. Western, but categorized as more Japanese style classic cuisine. That's a yoshoku. Yes. That's a whole another, we can do the episode maybe.
Yes.
But but then, like you said, you know, the home version, not right. the powder, but it's a colorful boxes and it's almost like a cube. So you can just break it
right.
and
right.
as many as you want, as little as you want in the pot, and you keep cooking it, add your other ingredients like vegetables and, you know, onion, carrots yeah. and potatoes, and then you should leave it. Then
it tastes better the next day. Yeah.
Exactly.
So one of there are a number of dishes that are like that. And the ability to make it ahead and know that you could reheat it later made it popular with homemakers. And being able to heat it up. Schedules in Japan, I think one of the things that I remarked upon early on in my stay in Japan was the strange scheduling. It seemed so different, the coming and going of people in the household. The first lodgings that I had outside of the ICU dormitory was with a family in Mitaka. And the children were at different levels of school. Everybody had a different schedule, and everybody was eating at a different time. And the ability for the mother to be able to produce food constantly throughout the day. I mean, it was almost like a small cafeteria unto itself. And she definitely depended upon things like curry rice and others that could be made ahead, heated up, and it would taste even better the next day. One of the reasons, by the way, that food often tastes better the next day is because it's allowed to cool down. And often flavors settle in the cooling down stage. And that's true of a lot of dishes in classic Japanese food as well, where nimono are really better if they've had a chance to settle.
Yeah, in one of the curry is a five-day deal because day one, it's good, but then we just wait until you use the huge pot and then keep cooking, reduce. And can I just share kind of a silly story with my brother?
Please.
When we grew up, we were always fighting. But it's funny, curry is at the table. We had a curry deal, so-called. So when my mom was not looking, I didn't like potato in the curry. My brother didn't like carrots. So we just switch. And that was the only time we were very friendly to each other. But then when the curry keeps cooking and there's no form of potato or carrots because it's melting down, it's all that really delicious sauce, thick sauce.
Right.
So we're always fighting for the last serving of the curry. So that was the curry story of my hair.
It sounds familiar. I'm also a carrot lover. I mean, I like potatoes too, but I would also opt for carrots, I think, instead of the potatoes. But it's true. Everything cooks down to the point where it's almost not recognizable. And the other advantage of something like curry is you can add to it. So if suddenly you need an extra portion, you've got this sort of starter base and you can build on it and add more carrots, more potatoes, more chicken, more whatever it was that was originally in there, or add something new and change the character of it. So certainly that worked well. It's also interesting, lots of products in Japan, especially now, have manufacturers associations, they group together for the benefit, even though they are rivals on the market, if you will, they are of a single category and they group together to enable the category to be promoted. And that's certainly true of the All Japan Curry Manufacturers Association, which was an early, immediate post-war group, and they're still very active. And with all of the searching that I did on the internet, I could really not find a reason why January 22nd was chosen as Curry Rice Day. But it was, and it was institutionalized in the school lunch program on the 35th anniversary by declaring January 22nd to be Curry Rice Day. And there's no combination of, sometimes in Japan, they will use puns on numbers. For example, the 29th of every month is 2 and 9, or ni and ku, and niku is meat. So a lot of stores will have special sales on meat on the 29th.
Right. Well, I'm sure you can find any day there's a certain kind of food designated for that kind of food.
Probably. But no matter how I tried to work the numbers for January and 22nd, it didn't turn out to be curry. So if any reader knows the answer to that, they should write in and they should let us all know.
Or maybe that's the only day left for anything else.
Maybe.
Right. But like, you know, you mentioned that the cube style instant curry cubes or the packaged products, that's like the dominant companies like SB and House. These are really a market leader, and they diversify the flavors depending on the family's preference, like spicier or sweeter. The kids tend to be more into sweeter curry. When I grew up, it was sweeter, and as I grew up, it became hotter. So that's a variation, right? And also you have like microwavable, more convenient products developed. Yeah. So that's how, despite the short history of Japanese curry, it's so dominant, and it's interesting that our listeners can use it, make it today.
I'm curious about something. Probably the single most popular product is something called Bamanto curry, Vermont curry. Why Vermont? I mean, to my knowledge, there's nothing in New England that connects it to curry.
Wait, what I heard, I'm not sure, but Vermont somehow, that Vermont curry from house had some apples and honey to make it sweeter so that it can appeal to kids. And somehow Vermont has an image of like apples. Good, delicious. I have no idea
how
the production level of curries, either apples and honey in Vermont, but that's what, in many cases, that's like just crazy imagination. That's what I heard, but I have to ask.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into the unique style of Japanese curry and how to make it. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Elizabeth Ando, a food writer, cookbook author, and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So let's talk about Japanese style curries. So what is the difference between the style of Japanese curry and other countries, such as India and Thailand?
I must admit that my experience with curry has been primarily Japan, and I'm not all that familiar with curries from other places. But Japanese curry is very thick, and my impression of, or at least the Thai and so-called Indian curry that I've eaten here in Japan, has been much thinner and differently spiced. There are sort of characteristic spices that seem to be more associated, at least in my mind, with Japan than with others. And but I don't know. Do you eat a lot of other curry?
I grew up in Japan and ate Japanese style curry, but then there are a couple very classic Indian style restaurants. That's serving traditional curry. I was shocked at how different they are. And I think, as far as I understand, Indian curry is very different because even north and south, there's a difference. For religious reasons, they don't use beef or pork, and Japanese people eat beef or pork and chicken, of course. But I think they use chicken, lamb, seafood, vegetables, and beans, and just different texture and different flavor. And also, I think the southern part, the texture is thinner, and they're often flavored with coconut milk and curry leaves and, you know, served with rice. Whereas in the north, they have more wheat-producing region. So they have flatbreads like naan or chapati. Right. And that was what I had in Tokyo a long time ago. And I was like, wow, naan is ridiculously good.
I love naan.
And then, but in Thailand, I think the Thai curry tend to be spicier, like really like hot, spicy, and thinner. like more liquid. And then they use more fresh herbs and than Indian curries and lemongrass and kaffir lime and all those beautiful herbal flavor. And then one time I spent some time with the people from Thailand. They are carrying chili in a plastic bag. So their level of spiciness is a completely different level. And and the other thing, I think Japanese curries difference between Thai or India, Thailand or India, Japanese rice is Japonica rice, which is sticky. And whereas other southern part of Asia, they tend to eat indica, which is longer and less sticky. So I think that stickiness of Japanese rice and also thick curry style kind of goes together and make it the heavier dish and kind of a comfort food and addictive. And I don't think it's a low-calorie food, but
you don't think
that's
so.
Why, that's why I think people like Japanese curry in Japan, because it's so satisfying.
I was going to say, it's very satisfying. It's usually inexpensive. And there are so many ways to vary it that eating it once a week, several times a week, is not difficult. The other thing I was going to say is the few times I've had Thai curry here, at least in Japan, it's always had coconut milk in it. And that seemed to be a very distinctive flavor. One that had was new to me, again, because it's not used in Japan or in Japanese food at all. And also the level of spiciness. It's true that Japan does have things like wasabi, but in general, spiciness is an accent to food here in most Japanese dishes rather than it being a main flavor. With many of the other Asian curries, it seemed that the heat was a major component.
Right. It's like a sancho wasabi. The spiciness is kind of elusive. It just disappears and, oh, don't go, but it's gone. So, but I think the point is Japanese curry and India or Thailand and curry from India or Thailand or other parts of the world are very different. And if you just try to think of Japanese curry is something similar to Southern Asian style curries. This is really different. So that's the basic understanding of Japanese curry. So, and in Japan, when they say curry, people instantly think of Japanese curry rice in most cases. So, which is interesting because Japanese style curry over the sticky rice has certain rules from depending on who you are. So, and there is an interesting debate about how you eat curry rice. So do you mix the rice and the roux or eat separately and gradually mix rice and the sauce as you proceed? Which one are you?
I'm a gradually mix, I guess. I had never really thought about it, but when you had asked me to think about it, I remember the vision again at the cafeteria at ICU, where indeed there was a definite grouping of people who did it one way or the other. And I never thought about it before, but I guess maybe the early friends that I made there were were those who taught me how to eat it, and it was gradually adding it, or maybe because I always had a double portion of rice. It mixed easily afterwards. Which are you?
I'm like you. I just want to gradually have different taste over the course of finishing the dish. But some people say because the curry can be very hot because it's a thick sauce, by mixing it, you can lower the temperature, and without burning your mouth, you can eat it. So that's another technical reason to mix.
I'll consider it, but probably old habits are hard to break.
I think so too. So curry rice is very popular, but it's hard to make it from scratch. Like some people don't use the roux, like the blocks, but it's just a very hardcore. I don't know how many people do it, but there are other types of curry flavored products.
Right.
And, you know, so what kind of forms are there in Japanese market?
Well, probably the most common is kare pan, a kind of bread. It's stuffed with very thick curry and deep fried. And it's considered not really a meal so much as a snack, but it's a very filling and quite caloric, quite delicious snack to have. But certainly most bakeries will have some kind of curry pan available. The other is curry udon, which seems to be attributed to Waseda University and a particular restaurant that eventually closed just before the pandemic, as a matter of fact. It no longer is there. That would serve curry udon to a student population. And again, it seemed to be a very good way to serve lunch to a group of students that had a limited budget, limited time, and wanted something very filling. But the date that was given for the first serving of curry udon at this particular restaurant was 1904. So it was, a long time ago. And the other is katsu curry, where you have tonkatsu, a fried pork cutlet, and you put curry roux on top of that. And that's attributed to a baseball player, Shigeru Chiba. And he was born, I think, in 1920 or around that time, and passed away early in this century, 2002 or three, something like that. And he had asked for it at this yoshokuya, this uniquely Japanese Western-style food that was in Ginza. And other people saw him eating it, heard him ordering it. Other people started to serve it, and it became popular in that way. But for me, curry pan, curry udon, and katsu curry are probably the three things that I think of when I don't think of just curry as served over rice.
Right. I agree. There will be your top three. And for example, curry udon. Udon is wheat flour based, and it's thick noodles. So it can hold that weight of thick sauce of curry.
Yes.
And it really makes sense that the curry's kind of thickness really creates diversity of the style, because if it's liquid, like a Thai curry, you can make it in the bread, curry pan, right? So, yeah, that's the thickness of the sauce. That's distinctively unique about Japanese curry. Right.
I was going to say, for people who are maybe having trouble imagining what that would be like, I would call it a jelly donut, but instead of jelly, you've got curry on the inside.
Right.
And it does ooze out in much the same way.
Yeah, that is a good one to describe it. Yeah, and it's the curry rice and the curry pan and the curry udon. They're all served at the school lunches too. So everybody in Japan is exposed to this deliciousness and comforting taste of curry. Right. And of course, usually it's mixed with some kind of meat, vegetables, really like nutritious elements already incorporated in curry. So it's not just thick and maybe a little higher in calories, but it's really nourishing as well. So that's another reason.
And certainly school lunches. I can remember when my daughter was little and like many children, did not love cabbage or a lot of onions, and one way of and carrots even, one way of sort of hiding those foods and making them more palatable was to put them in curry. And also in things like gyoza or shumai. So chopping it up or including it in with other more distinctive flavors was one way of serving a nutritionally balanced components in school lunches. And certainly curry in whatever form is one of the most popular school lunch items.
Right. So before they know it, the reason curry is so delicious is just thanks to onions and carrots and cabbage and they didn't like. So they grew to be healthy eaters before they knew it. Right. And also the, you know, the curry pan, curry udon, curry, katsu curry, those things can be available at the convenience stores, supermarkets, or not to mention specialty stores. So it's available everywhere and it's not expensive either. So it's that's why another reason it's so popular. Curry, Japanese curry is so popular. So, and you know how to cook great Japanese curry. So what is your favorite recipe that you, our listeners can use?
Well, I do a version. There's a Japanese dish called soboro, which is usually made with ground chicken meat, which is very easily available here in Japan. In America, ground turkey is more readily available, and other things like beef or pork or even lamb. But here in Japan, the sort of default mode for a ground meat is going to be chicken and usually dark meat chicken. It's more flavorful. And the classic sort of soboro is done with soy sauce, slightly sweet with mirin or sugar added to it, and perhaps a hint of ginger. And then it's served over rice and often with other vegetables. And so I do a curry version of that. I, rather than some of the more popular packaged roux, there is a product on the market here in Japan. I don't know if it's elsewhere, put out by Mascotto. That's a very thick paste, and it's very easy to use and to sort of boost the flavors of other things. I also do have a number of dry spices that I sometimes add on my own, but my basic is a soboro recipe, and it's on my website. I'm not the curry version, the original soboro version is up on the website, and you could add curry flavor to that.
Right, so that's a Taste of Culture book.
Right, tasteofculture.com, and there's lots of resources up there. And I recently had my webmaster redo the search function. So hopefully it will be easier for people to find things on my site easier than it was before, even with single words. So
okay. So soboro, it's S-O-B-O-R-O, soboro. I'm just looking at your website. Yeah, okay. Beautiful. Right. Ooh, that looks good. Yeah, basically, but it can be, you know, the ground meat, chicken or beef or pork, right. Anything. And then basically you just go to a Japanese grocery shop and you can't miss colorful curry picture boxes, and it's right. It's available. And cubes, you can just throw in many cubes if you want.
House, S&B, and also Glico, G-L-I-C-O, mm-hmm. are probably the three main manufacturers domestically and also in terms of exports. Right. They probably dominate the shelf at any so-called Asian grocery store.
And these three companies have different varieties, flavors and
wildly
styles.
Different.
And also some different. Are boxed for microwave style. So,
yes.
Right. So the only problem is once you get into Japanese curry, it can be a little addictive. That's why people eat five times a week sometimes. And right. But you can really make it as vegetarian, vegan. And also, I think, you know, you don't have to make it too much. And you can have it a lot of vegetables
right.
and make it nutritious. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, the paste that I use, as a matter of fact, is vegetarian. So it doesn't have any... which enables me to either keep it vegetarian or to decide what flavor profile I want to add to it, and it doesn't sort of interfere with it. So I often will buy vegetarian versions of curry because then I can personalize it more easily.
Right. Okay, so yeah, again, if you make a big pot of curry, you can add different kinds of roux later, or you can add meat, or you can just really keep, there's a base of curry and you can just manipulate what's inside. Right. So that's the beauty. And then over the time, it just tastes even better. So that's really, why not eating curry, right? So, okay, so now I think we should wrap up gradually, but what are your plans and dreams, and what are you eating? Something you are interested in cooking, or some kind of plans?
I'm going to be continuing to give in-person lessons here. Anybody who's going to come to Tokyo, they should look at my website, and there's a request form, and they should fill that out. I'm doing a number of online, in terms of lectures, PowerPoint talks, and some of them have been archived up on my website again. You can listen to those, and I'll be doing several more this year and hope to be able to add to that collection as well. I probably would love to do another book, but it's very difficult to do traditional in the way it used to be done in Japan, in the rest of the world. I would say pre-pandemic publishing and post-pandemic publishing, especially in the cookbook world, has been really changed. And I'm not sure whether I'll be able to launch another cookbook project, but if anybody is interested, they should let me know. I'd love to be able to do that. But certainly in terms of encouraging people to learn more about Japan and Japan's food culture, my monthly newsletters, they're free of charge, but they're permission-based, so I can't sign up anybody. And you have to sign yourself up at my website. And please reply to the automated request for confirmation. Again, you don't land up on the list until you have replied that you're a real person who really intended to make that request to be on my list. I've got about 5,000 people, I get, on my list currently. And once a month, there's no particular date. I aim for earlier in the month. Sometimes it turns out to be a bit later. And also continuing to write for the Japan Times 6 times a year. It seems to be just the right pace for both me and for them. And they allow me to pick interesting, quirky subjects that I like and do it my way. and I have wonderful edit. Well, you don't always get that chance very often when you write for established publications. There are more than just guidelines or very specific requests. It's fun. And so twice a year, I propose several different ideas to them. And thus far, they have only sort of requested that I not do something only once. And so it's been grand fun to be able to do those. Yeah.
Well, I've been watching what you're doing, and your newsletter is so informative. And I think it's not just, there's so many Japanese food related articles, but it's like scratching the surface in many cases. And some go into deep history and accurate facts. But in your case, you are living in Japan. You've been living in Japan for a long time. You understand as an insider, as well as being American. New York grown woman. So you have a very different, diverse perspective, and also very curious about history and background. So yeah, I really enjoy reading your newsletters and other articles.
And I try very hard to make it, for those people who actually want to try to prepare the food, I try to give helpful instruction. The recipes and the material up on the website, and sort of breaking. So the newsletter usually chooses a theme, and that theme is carried through on two different pages on my website. One is sort of more historical, more subject interesting, and the other is more about practically actually trying to make it yourself. Projects.
So you don't have to try to crack a code of understanding recipes sometimes. So that's great. And yeah, and then Japanese people, I know the non-Japanese people can now go to Japan thanks to the end of COVID finally.
Yes.
So yeah, they can really enjoy the whole fresh culture and everything. All right. So I look forward to our next conversation and
likewise.
We maybe can discuss. Yeah. All right, so good luck. And
thank you.
So do you want to talk about where you can find your updates online on social media?
The best is to go to my website, tasteofculture.com. And there are different tabs for different sections of the website. And one of them will be about things that I've written, others about videos, lectures, and then my own blog. So pretty much all the information is collected on my website. And there are links there for Facebook and for, I still call it Twitter, X, an increasingly difficult to use platform, but I'm sticking with it for the time being.
Like everybody else.
Yes.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to the next episode with you.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe. This episode of Japan Needs was made possible with the support of Dasai. Dasai supports HRN's creative, educational reporting and storytelling that drives conversations to empower, educate, and entertain through food-focused podcasts and world-class education programs.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.